This is Tim Ferriss, and welcome to the Tim Ferriss Show. What you are about to hear is part two of a two-part conversation with Alex Blumberg, best known for his work with This American Life as co-host of Planet Money, and also co-founder of Gimlet Media, which has produced two blockbuster podcasts at the time of this particular episode, namely Startup and Reply All. He is a true master of storytelling, crafting narrative, radio, interviewing, and much more. If you didn't catch the first part, you might want to do that before venturing in, but you can certainly listen to this independently. This second part is an excerpt from a masterclass that he taught on creativelive.com. I think it costs about $99, and it is phenomenal. Specifically, in this portion, we are going to look at the art of the interview and how to craft and find the perfect question. So I hope you enjoy it. And without further ado, please enjoy part two of the Tim Ferriss Show with Alex Blumberg. Optimal
minimal. At this altitude, I can run flat out for a half mile before my hands start shaking.
Can I ask you a personal question?
Now would have seemed an appropriate time.
What if I did the opposite?
I'm a cybernetic organism, living tissue over a metal endoskeleton.
The Tim Ferriss Show.
This episode is brought to you by Athletic Greens. I get asked all the time what I would take if I could only take one supplement. The answer is invariably Athletic Greens. I view it as all-in-one nutritional insurance. I recommended it, in fact, in the 4-Hour Body. This is more than 10 years ago, and I did not get paid to do so. With approximately 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food-sourced ingredients, you'd be very hard-pressed to find a more nutrient-dense and comprehensive formula on the market. It has multivitamins, multimineral greens complex, probiotics and prebiotics for gut health, an immunity formula, digestive enzymes, adaptogens, and much more. I usually take it once or twice a day just to make sure I've covered my bases if I miss anything I'm not aware of. Of course, I focus on nutrient-dense meals to begin with. That's the basis. But Athletic Greens makes it easy to get a lot of nutrition when whole foods aren't readily available. From travel packets, I always have them in my bag when I'm zipping around. Right now, Athletic Greens is giving my audience a special offer on top of their all-in-one formula, which is a free vitamin D supplement and 5 free travel packs with your first subscription purchase. Many of us are deficient in vitamin D. I've found that true for myself, which is usually produced in our bodies from sun exposure. So adding a vitamin D supplement to your daily routine is a great option for additional immune support. Support your immunity, gut health, and energy by visiting athleticgreens.com/TFS. You'll receive up to a year's supply of vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your subscription. Again, that's athleticgreens.com/TFS, as in Tim Ferriss Show. athleticgreens.com/TFS.
This episode is brought to you by 5-Bullet Friday, my very own email newsletter. It's become one of the most popular email newsletters in the world with millions of subscribers, and it's super, super simple. It does not clog up your inbox. Every Friday, I send out 5 bullet points, super short, of the coolest things I've found that week, which sometimes includes apps, books, documentaries, supplements, gadgets, new self-experiments, hacks, tricks, and all sorts of weird stuff that I dig up from around the world. You guys, podcast listeners and book readers, have asked me for something short and action-packed for a very long time, because after all, the podcast, the books, they can be quite long. And that's why I created 5-Bullet Friday. It's become one of my favorite things I do every week. It's free. It's always going to be free. And you can learn more at tim.blog/Friday. That's tim.blog/Friday. I get asked a lot how I meet guests for the podcast, some of the most amazing people I've ever interacted with. And little known fact, I've met probably 25% of them because they first subscribed to 5-Bullet Friday. So you'll be in good company. It's a lot of fun. 5-Bullet Friday is only available if you subscribe via email. I do not publish the content on the blog or anywhere else. Also, if I'm doing small in-person meetups, offering early access to startups, beta testing, special deals, or anything else that's very limited, I share it first with 5-Bullet Friday subscribers. So check it out, tim.blog/Friday. If you listen to this podcast, it's very likely that you'd dig it a lot. And you can, of course, easily subscribe anytime. So easy peasy. Again, that's tim.blog/Friday. And thanks for checking it out, if the spirit moves you.
What we're going to be talking about in this segment is the art of the interview. And what I'm going to be covering today. What I'm going to be covering in this section is, first of all, like sort of the most basic question, which is what are you going for when you're interviewing somebody? What are you trying to get out of it? What is the thing that you want to? What does a good interview look like? Right? What does it feel like when it's happening? And as part of that, I'm going to go through what to ask. How do you come up with the questions to ask? And I'm going to be talking a little bit about the power of the right question. And then I'm also going to be talking about nuts and bolts. So that's coming up. What are you going for? So the first thing that you're going for is what we talked about in the last section, which is authentic moments of, you know, sort of authentic moments of authentic emotion, authentic sort of realization, authentic moments of humor, something that feels like a real emotion. Like those are golden moments in an interview, and that's one of the things that you absolutely want to go for. And we talked a little bit about that before, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit later. But the thing that I want to focus on now is the other thing that we're talking about is stories. I have a very specific meaning when I say what an actual story is. I think the first thing to do is to play you a little bit of what I'm talking about when I'm talking about a story. So I'm going to play you a little piece of tape. So this is a story that was on This American Life a while ago. And the setup is that it's this actor, Tate Donovan. And Tate Donovan was a sort of a character actor. He'd been, you know, sort of on a couple of different shows, but he didn't get recognized very much. And then he had a stint on Friends. And all of a sudden he was starting to get recognized. And it was really exciting for him to be recognized because he finally got to be the celebrity that he always wished that he could be, the celebrity that he would have wanted to meet before he was famous. So when he got recognized, this story happens when one night he was out at this Broadway show, and a lot of people were coming up to him and being like, "Hey, I saw you." And he was able to, like, talk to people and be very magnanimous and say, "Thank you so much. It really means a lot." And he was, like, posing for pictures for people. And it was at the show. It was happening over and over and over again.
I was exactly how I wanted to be. I was doing it. I was doing great. And then the kid with the camera came along. This nervous kid. He must have been 16 years old. He's in a rented tuxedo. Unbelievably, like, shy and awkward, and he's got, like, acne, and he's got a camera in his hand. And underneath the marquee is his date, who is literally like a prom dress, and she's got a corsage, and she's really, you know, nervous and sort of clutching her hands. And he sort of comes up to me, and he sort of mumbles, you know, something like, you know, something about a picture. And I'm like, I just feel for him. So I'm like, "Oh, absolutely. My gosh, sure. I have no problem. My God, you poor thing." And I go up to his girlfriend. I wrap my arms around her. And I'm like, "Hey, where are you from? Fantastic. Going to see the play. It's great." And the guy is sort of not taking the photograph very quickly. He's just sort of staring at me. And he's got his camera in his hands. And it's down by his, like, chin, you know. And she's very stiff and awkward. And I don't know what to do, so I just lean across and I kiss her on the cheek. And I'm like, "All right, come on, take the picture, hurry up."
Do you guys want to find out what happens next?
Yeah.
That's a story. That is the power of a good narrative. So when I talk about, I'm talking about, like, those two basic things you're going for: emotion and narrative. We as humans are hardwired, I believe, to listen to narrative. And it's a very simple, sort of the mechanics of narrative are very simple. There's, like, a sequence of actions, and there's sort of rising action, and it's culminating in something. And you were in the middle of that sequence of actions, and you were about to get to the culmination, and I stopped it. And it's frustrating. And you really want to know what happens next. And you would never, if you were listening to this, have turned off that podcast or that radio story at that moment. And that is a good story. And that's why you want to operate in stories. That's why when you're interviewing people, you want to get their stories out of them. And you want to get them talking in stories. Because stories are what we want to hear. And so when you're working in an audio format, you need to operate in stories. The other thing we want to hear, as we heard before, is emotion. So those are the two things you're going for in a good interview. So moving on. Actually, do you want to hear what happens next? All right. All right. I'll rewind it again, and then we'll have it play out.
You know, I don't know what to do, so I just lean across, and I kiss her on the cheek. And I'm like, all right, come on, take the picture, hurry up. And finally, he sort of, like, snaps it. And I'm like, okay, it was really wonderful to meet you. And he just, like, stammered over to me and was like, could you take a picture of us?
Oh.
And the whole time, he just wanted me to take a picture of him and his girlfriend underneath the awning of the play. He didn't want a picture of me. He had no idea who I was. Oh, God.
Got a little emotion in there, too. Yeah. So that is what I'm talking about when a story. So like a very, very simply, we're going to be talking a lot more about what story is in the next session. But very, very simply, it is that. It is a sequence of actions that culminates in something, some sort of revelation, some sort of punchline, some sort of joke, some sort of like realization. And more to the point, it's something that you don't want to turn off, that you don't want to stop listening to. And so that is the thing that's in your mind when you're going out and doing an interview with anybody. You want to ask questions of the interview subject that are going to either elicit an honest emotional reaction or that are going to elicit them telling you a story. And there's a lot of things that you can ask that will. So let's talk about that. So what to ask, right? So first, if you're trying to ask questions that will elicit a story. First of all, you don't want to ask ever really yes or no questions. I mean, you got to get some facts out of the way, but you don't want to ask a yes or no question because that's the end of a story, right? How you phrase the questions is very, very important. You want to sort of ask questions. I often sort of say, tell me about the time when, right? Something, you know, you were just like, you want them to tell you. You use words like, tell me. So they're automatically starting to talk to you in story language. Tell me about the time. Tell me about the day when you blah, blah, blah. Tell me about the moment when you realized that this was what was going to happen. Tell me about the time in your life when you were going through this thing. Another question that works really well, tell me the story of. Just ask them straight up, right? You know, tell me the story of this. How did this happen? Tell me the story. You know, sometimes that works. Another thing that when you're on the right track is when people are actually sort of like talking to you in dialogue. If somebody is saying, well, first I said, and then she said, and then I said, that's really that you know you're on the right track here. So often I will tell people, you know, describe the conversation where blah, blah, blah. And because if you get people sort of telling you like, he said, then she said, then he said, then she said, that's great. You know you're on the right track. That somebody is telling you a story right then. Because they're quoting dialogue to you. again, tell me about the often what you're going for is a moment of realization. So a story has to culminate in something. Often the thing it's culminating in is a moment of realization. So you want to say, tell me about the day that you realize whatever it is that we're talking about here. Another thing that really works well is if people can sort of talk through a process of, you know, there's often steps that led from one situation to the other situation. What were the steps that got you from one thing to another? What were the steps that got you from, you know, your career in the army to your career as a celebrity florist or whatever, right? So anybody here have that career trajectory, by the way? So you want to ask that, like sort of what were the steps? If you can get people breaking it down into steps, and often each step is its own story. So often step one will be, well, I had my career in the army, and this one thing happened when I was, you know, in the army. This day happened that made me want to change. And so they'll tell you that, and that's a story. Each step can be its own story, but that sequence of steps is also a story. So these are all sort of questions that will elicit stories. You want to have people back up. You want to do all that stuff. All right. So that's one whole set of questions. And often when you're doing... So that's a whole set of questions. The other set of questions, so what do you ask if there's a whole other set of questions that are built around eliciting sort of honest reflection and emotion? So that's the other stock and trade. That's the other thing that you're going for, right? It's pretty simple, two things. So what do you ask when you're trying to get people to tell you, tell you how they feel? One question is, how did that make you feel? it's pretty straightforward. I often joke that like doing a good interview for audio and having a good sort of therapy session look very similar. Because what you are trying to do is get people to articulate their emotions in words. All you have in audio are words. That's all you have. You have people's words. And so if they're feeling something... It's like if something happens and you're not shooting it, it didn't happen. If they're feeling something and they don't articulate it, it also didn't happen. So you need them to articulate the way they're feeling. And so a lot of what you're doing is you're in the audio, you're in the interview and you're like, I noticed feeling in your voice or in your manner, and I want you to articulate that feeling. So that's one thing. And so that's like, how did that make you feel? Is a big one. Often you also want to encourage that kind of reflection. Some people just aren't very naturally reflective, but they've gone through something sort of momentous, and you want them sort of like getting the emotion in there. So one good trick I've known is sort of like if the old new could see the new you, what would the old you say? Because often you're interviewing about something that has happened to them. They've gone through some sort of transition, and you want them to be able to articulate what that transition meant to them. And these are all tricks we're going to use, by the way, on one of our audience members, Anne, coming up. So we're going to do a live interview coming up in another section. So take notes, because we're going to have to employ this, use this in action. A lot of what emotion is around internal conflict. And this is one of the things that I love about audio, which audio can do uniquely well, is that it can give voice to, interior drama. If there's on television, you can sort of see people looking pensively, or you can get across an internal life, but stuff has to happen on tape. It has to be happening. And with audio, if you can get people to give voice to the internal conflict, it has the power of any kind of real drama. So what I often say to people is like, I'll often say like, so conflict, you're going for conflict, but it can be conflict within a person. It can be a person feeling conflicted about something. And so a big question that I use a lot, which is sort of like, just if you had to describe the debate in your head over this moment, over this act that you took, what was one side saying? What was the other side saying? And it's just getting people to sort of like voice the feelings that they're having. And often our feelings are contradictory, right? And so you want that, and that's great. If people have a conflicted feeling when you're interviewing them, that's a wonderful thing too. That's what you want. Because that's a way of breaking out of what you were talking about, Anne, which is the canned thing. Part of what being canned is just having like a, sort of like a very, very straightforward feeling about it that you don't necessarily believe, but you can't shake people out of. And so what you want is to sort of like get at like, what was the conflict? Was there ever a point where you didn't feel so confident about this? Was there ever a point where you like felt differently? And sometimes it can be just as simple as sort of like, you seem very confident right now. Was that always the case? And if they say no, then just zero in on that. Like zero in on the weakness, the emotion, right? Like that's what your job is, right? Another question that I would often happens in an interview, and I bet you this will happen to you as you're doing your interviews. Somebody will say something, and it feels like very important to them. Like they've said something that is meaningful. You're talking to like a rail yard worker, and they'll be like, well, and then the boss gave us like, extra hours. And they say it like, and you're like, Wow, the boss gave you extra hours. You're saying it like it's important, and I have no idea what it means. But it means something to you. There's emotion in the voice, right? Like, what does that mean? And so, and often you, and I would always flub this thing. I would know that there was something that they were getting at, but they weren't articulating it to me. And then Ira uses this question all the time, and it's a really great question, and it's super straightforward. It's just sort of like, what do you make of that? And so I say it all the time now, because like I just need them to tell me the reason that there's emotion in the thing that they just said. So what do you make of that? It's a really important question. The other thing that I think one of the most important things that we, which is, you know, sort of like part of the what do you make of that question? Again, you sort of ask, what do you make of that? And then it's sort of a dumb question. You sort of feel like an idiot for asking it. It's like sort of like basic and weird, and like it's not a question that you actually ask that often in normal conversation. And this gets to the point of sort of like, are you having a real conversation or are you having a staged conversation sort of to elicit certain things? And you're doing a little bit of both, right? And the what do you make of that is very much like a staged sort of therapy conversation. You know what I mean? But really important is to then shut up. I can't get across enough the importance of shutting up. And like early on in my career, I would come back and I would just be talking so much, and people would start to be telling me interesting things, and I would be talking over them, and it was all because I was nervous and I was worried about like sort of making them feel uncomfortable. And you sort of want them to feel uncomfortable a little bit, not totally uncomfortable, so that they're not going to be like talking to you. You want them to feel safe, but you want them to feel like they're saying something real, which is often uncomfortable. So you want it to be safe. You're not judgmental at all. You never want to be judgmental, but you want to be asking real questions. You want them to be thinking really about it. So another just sort of, you know, good question that sort of gets at this is the why is this story meaningful to you?
Coming up, the power of the right question and how to craft it to get honest responses, deep responses, including plenty of clips. But first, a short word from our sponsors. The Tim Ferriss Show is brought to you by Onnit. I have used Onnit products for years. If you look in my kitchen, in my garage, you will find Alpha Brain, chewable melatonin for resetting my clock when I'm traveling, kettlebells, battle ropes, maces, steel clubs. It sounds like a torture chamber, and it kind of is. It's a torture chamber for self-improvement. And you can see all of my favorite gear at onnit.com/Tim. That's onnit.com/Tim. And you can also get a discount on any supplements, food products. I like Hemp Force. I like Alpha Brain. Check it all out, onnit.com/Tim. The Tim Ferriss Show is also brought to you by 99 Designs. 99 Designs is your one-stop shop for anything graphic design related. You need a logo, you need a website, you need a business card, or anything else. You get an original design from designers around the world who submit drafts for you to review. You are happy or you get your money back. And I have used 99 Designs for book cover ideas for the 4-Hour Body, which went to number one New York Times, for banner ads. And you can check out some of my actual competitions at 99designs.com/Tim. You can also get a free $99 upgrade if you want to give it a shot. That's 99designs.com/Tim. And now back to the show.
So just to sort of get across like sort of like the power of like sort of what this question, you know, asking the right question. I want to play a couple clips of tape here. And this first one is like a story that we did on. So this first sort of like illustration of the power of asking the right question and getting people, you know, to reflect honestly. It's a weird story. It was a sort of this really conceptual story that we did at This American Life a while ago. And it was this reporter named Davey Rothbart, and I was the producer on the story, so I went out with him and asked all these questions. And the conceptual story was this. Davey lived on this block in Chicago. It was sort of a block in transition. There was like some sort of yuppies moving in, but it had been sort of like a poor There were some gang problems there, and it was like a sort of it was a neighborhood in transition. And he lived on this block, and there was all these problems that the neighborhood was having with each other. Like different neighbors were like having different conflicts with each other, and there was like a neighbor in his building who was complaining about his loud music and was constantly banging on the floor. And then there was another neighbor that had thought that that somebody else stole her dog. And then there was so there's all these things. And the idea was that Davey was going to sort of collect all these problems, interview all the people in his neighborhood, and then take the problems that were happening in this neighborhood to an expert on neighbor relations.
Call it 540 for round figures.
Whoops. I set up the wrong piece of tape. I mean, sorry. Crap. There it is right there in my notes. I missed it. I'm going to set up a different piece of tape. This is another piece of tape. This will be very quickly. Sorry. Keep all that in your mind for a second. there's two stories I'm going to play. I'm going to play the first one now in order. So this is a different story. This was one that I did on the housing crisis. This is a story from 2008. And it was one of the more famous stories I did. It was called The Giant Pool of Money, and it was about the housing meltdown, basically. Back in 2008, there was all this stuff happening with subprime mortgages, and a lot of the coverage was about who's at fault. Is it were deadbeats taking out loans that they knew they couldn't pay back and then ripping off the banks, or were poor people being victimized by evil banks that were now foreclosing on their homes? And that was the narrative. And neither narrative really ever made sense to me. And I kept on thinking there's something else going on here, something bigger and more systemic that's going on than just either people ripping off banks or banks ripping off people. And I wanted to get at the heart of it. And there was this question. So we found this guy who was who was going through foreclosure, and he was telling the story of how he got this loan, this enormous loan. And in the middle of this clip, you'll hear the question that I'm talking about, the question that I felt turned the whole thing and sort of set up the entire show, as a matter of fact, but sort of got him talking in a very different way. So this guy's name is Clarence. He'd taken out a huge loan, almost over $500,000. At the time of that loan, he had three not very reliable part-time jobs. He was making about $45,000 a year. And on the loan that he took out, they didn't ask him anything about his income.
Call it 540 for round figures.
You basically borrowed $540,000 from the bank, and they didn't check your income.
Right. It's a no-income verification loan. They don't call me up and say, how much money? They don't do that. I mean, it's almost like you pass a guy in the street and you say, you lend me $540,000? He said, well, what do you do? I got a job. Okay. I mean, it seems as if it's that casual, even though there are a lot of papers that get filled out and stuff flies all over with the faxes and the emails and all like that. Essentially, that's the process.
Would you have loaned you the money?
I wouldn't have loaned me the money, and nobody that I know would have loaned me the money. I mean, I know guys who are criminals that wouldn't lend me that money, and they'd break your kneecap. So, I don't know why the bank did it. I'm serious. I mean, $540,000, a person with bad credit.
So I love that piece of tape because, it was the first time that in my experience that anybody... First of all, Clarence is at the center of the problem, and I'm asking him how he feels about... that question enabled me to sidestep the whole whose fault is it, in a way, and it just got to a very honest reaction from him, which was sort of there's all sorts of other ways to phrase that question. Did you deserve that money? Should the bank have given you that money? Blah, blah, blah. And all that would have led to a defensive answer. It would have led to not the right answer. But then when I was in the middle of it, I remember thinking that's the question. And when I asked him, would you have loaned you the money? It forced him to be honest. There was no way to sort of not be honest about answering that question. And it got a really wonderful sort of honest response that then set up the entire hour, basically. So why were other people lending money to people that those people themselves would not have lent to them? Right. So what was going on there? And that sort of that question set up the entire thing. All right. So I teased this next piece of tape mistakenly. So going back, cast your minds back to when I set this up before. So anyway, Davy Rothbart, getting all these questions from his the people in his neighborhood, and he's all the problems, and he's running it by an expert in neighbor relations.
The bridge in the daytime.
Anybody know who this is? Mr. Rogers, yes. Mr. Rogers, who's since passed away. Fred Rogers. So, like I said, it was a weird conceptual story. We're taking these problems from this sort of rough block of West Augusta in Chicago and then bringing them in front of Mr. Rogers and asking him to sort of pronounce judgment on what these neighbors should do. There's a backstory that I won't even get into. I bring it up all to sort of talk about because this was one of these moments where the question really brought us to a different place. So one of the problems that Davy had identified, I'm going to play one more piece of tape and then we'll get to the tape with the question. So one of the problems that Davy had identified in his neighborhood was that there was this fear, right? That was one of the big things. So there was the people banging on the floor, and the music playing too loud. There was a guy whose neighbor thought he'd stole her dog. But mainly there was a lot of fear. There was the fear of the yuppies moving into the neighborhood were afraid of the kids who were in the gangs. And so Davy talked about that. And you'll hear Davy and then you'll hear a kid named The Mouth who he's interviewing.
Who exactly are you afraid of, I'd ask? They all answered the same way. The gangbangers. The kids in baggy jeans and basketball jerseys who cruised the neighborhood with their stereos bumping. The gangbangers, they said, those are the bad neighbors.
Maybe even 10.
I guess it's no surprise The Mouth had his own idea about who the bad neighbors are, the ones who fear and distrust him.
There was a neighbor in the neighborhood that he didn't agree with what we did so much, so he'd stand in his house with a video camera and record what we were doing, try to bring it to the beat meetings, He used to follow us around with cameras, literally follow us around the neighborhood with cameras, and say, I'm going to call the cops on you, and... well, for what? We ain't bothering you, That's what I think the worst neighbor is,
Yeah. They come in here fearing us, saying that, maybe thinking that we're going to do this and do that, but we'll talk to you, what I'm saying, bro? We ain't animals, bro. We're normal people like you.
All right, so that's The Mouth and his friends who are sitting on the street drinking Heinekens. And so we bring that to Mr. Rogers. And so Mr. Rogers is a wonderful, lovely man. Meeting him was a thrill. He's got this strange sort of power when you meet him. It was crazy. When we went to meet him, his assistant said, we were trying to set up the interview, and his assistant was like, well, Fred likes to be nearby a piano. So we had to meet him in his studio so that he could play the piano every once in a while. He had the bag of puppets. And he would bring them out sometimes to make a point and start talking in the puppet voices while we were talking to him. And yet somehow it was moving and real. I don't know. He was an amazing person, amazing. But he was giving us a little bit of canned answers. When we were answering sort of what should this neighbor do, his answer was always sort of the same. I hope I would be brave enough to go and talk to them.
I would hope that I would be brave enough to visit. It's so easy to condemn when we don't know. And if I would visit you and find out that you are a reasonable person, I could tell you about my sensitivities and see if it would make any difference to you.
It's funny, a lot of the things, you said if you were in Davy's neighbor situation, you said that you hoped you would have enough courage to go down and visit. And a lot of what you were finding when you were talking to people had to do with that same sort of notion. And I'm wondering, what is it that we're afraid of, do you think?
Perhaps we think that we won't find another human being inside that person. Perhaps we think that, there maybe are people in this world who I can't ever communicate with. and so I'll just give up before I try. And how sad it is to think that we would give up on any other creature who's just like us.
So, what are your thoughts about that? Like, I'd love to hear what was going on in your mind. Anybody respond? Yeah, Anne.
That was Mr. Rogers. Like, that was so powerful.
Yeah.
And you could hear the flutter in his voice, which was his emotion, you know, rippling through his vocal cords.
Right.
And it was amazing. And it was such an interesting contrast to think of Mr. Rogers and, like, it sounded like the Buddha.
Right, wonderful. Exactly.
Wonderful.
He's very Buddha-like in person, yeah.
Yeah.
But it was like, but that was the most honest moment in that interview. You know, and it came out of, like, there was this question that was sort of hovering over it, and he was giving slightly, I hear this, and I wonder if you do too, like, in the beginning, he sounded more canned, and then after I asked the question, right, you can hear it, all of a sudden he's actually pausing, and he's actually thinking, and he's actually trying to figure out what is the emotion, and he's trying to voice that emotion, and all of a sudden it becomes real, and it becomes authentic, and you connect to that moment. Yeah, yeah.
I think the fact that he is Mr. Rogers carries particular weight.
Yeah.
We're used to hearing him and we're used to hearing him do those canned, simple, solutions oriented, just do this and it'll all be great. For me, that moment of real darkness when he identifies the greatest fear is I will never be able to communicate with you.
Right. Yeah.
And as a listener, I can extrapolate that out to the neighborhood. It's like, I can see how that person would think that about that person. And he just took me somewhere so hopeless.
Yeah.
When he's usually someone who's all about hope and positivity and it's going to be great.
Yeah.
So that juxtaposition of what I expect to hear from him and then what I hear from him is incredibly powerful.
Right. And I think that's a really great point, because I think that's what you're trying to do with it. That's what an honest moment will do with anybody, whether it's Mr. Rogers or not. If you hear people talking and the way we all talk, we're all sort of like, you know, going through, we're putting up fronts and lying to ourselves in various ways as we go through our day. You know, nobody's going to notice that I actually screwed up the order of my tape, for example. But you know, that when they break out, when you break out of it, even if you're not Mr. Rogers, that it that's what comes through. That's the thing that comes through. Go ahead.
Yeah. I was just going to say that he really took something that maybe many of us could not relate to, like living in a project. And when he answered that, when you asked that question about fear, it made it so personal that I immediately was thinking to myself, what am I fearing? And he took this kind of out there thing and brought it deep.
Yeah.
And so because it was personal, then it was more important to me, like you said earlier in the day, right?
Yeah.
And I engaged with that immediately.
Yeah, right. And he was identifying something. I mean, again, that's also sort of like identifying, putting words to a feeling that we have that is sort of undiagnosed or sort of explained. That is sort of a definition of profundity a little bit. You know what I mean? When you can actually give voice to, but you know, put that in words, the feeling that we share. And that's what he did with, I like, oh, that is our fear. That is the fear. Right, we're afraid that people that we are going to encounter somebody who we can't connect with as humans. Yeah, yeah.
I think it's also incredible because he uses his own language. He doesn't break out of being Mr. Rogers.
Right.
You know, he actually manages to remain himself and still go to this really different place for him. And that's how at least I could tell it was really honest. Was that he like. You also get to know Mr. Rogers honestly in his language.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And you can see why, like, Mr. Rogers of all people would find that an especially horrifying thing, you know, like, that, like, oh, the people that there are bad people in the world is just like such a, you know, it's like it's more poignant for Mr. Rogers than any of us. Yeah. Morgan, yeah.
Just going off of that, at the end he uses the word creature instead of like another human. It's like we're all just these beings that need to like connect with another being. Yeah. It's not within our organism.
Yeah. Yeah.
We have a few more coming in from the chat room. Jennifer says, of all people, coming from someone who so genuinely and innocently sees the beauty in people, acknowledging that core fear is really powerful. And Claudia says, you can feel how carefully he's thinking about the question, and that makes it very authentic.
Absolutely, absolutely. Like, you can hear it. For the first time, he didn't have a ready answer.
Yeah.
You know, and that's important, too. And again, like, I don't think that moment would have happened. You know, I often feel like there's, like, in every interview, or in a lot of interviews, there's, like, this, there's a question that's sort of hanging over the interview that if, like, you can just figure out what that question is, what's the one that's going to, like, sort of, like, what are we talking around? And can you figure out what that is and sort of present it to people? It breaks through often. Like, you, again, the therapy language, you have a breakthrough a little bit, you know, and that's what you're sort of going for. Yeah, Jeff.
I'm wondering if both of those clips ended up in the final cut and whether or not you like including that transition when you get the right question and that person changing from their canned response to the more personal, honest one.
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely. No, because you have to, yeah. No, those are both pulled from the actual final version. So, like, that's what the music was there and everything like that. I just downloaded the clip off of iTunes and put it in. Yeah, that was like the, yeah. But was that your answer or was that?
Well, I was wondering if you had gotten the second answer first, if that would have satisfied you, or if you like capturing that moment when you kind of break someone.
That's interesting. Over. Like, did you need the drama of him giving a canned answer first and then to, like, break through? There's something nice. I mean, there is something about that where it's nice to, like, that. It was the same thing that happened in the Dave Ramsey thing where somebody is not being totally honest and then there's a question that sort of confronts them. I don't know. That's a good question. It helps, I think, because it also sort of tells a story. It's like a chord. I feel like it's like a chord resolving in music when you're just like waiting for the chord, and then finally the power chord comes, and you're like, ah, that's how it feels a little bit, you know, where somebody is sort of like wrestling with it. They're not being honest, and then there's a question that breaks them out of it, and then they acknowledge. There's a nice feeling to that as well. But I think it could have worked either way. Like we often will use the answer without using the question, and it often is just as powerful. You know, you don't need to include the whole thing. You know, it's just how it works.
Alex, yeah. We had a couple of questions come in that I think tie in nicely to these clips that we just heard. So I'd love to get your opinion on this. So in that clip, you were talking about getting that location, that street in Chicago. So this ties into a question that Braden had, who says, when you're reporting on a town or a location, or with Mr. Rogers, a neighborhood, do you have a methodology for getting to know that town or that place?
God, that is... tricky. Do I have a methodology? No, I don't. My methodology is try to find somebody who knows it better than me. Is to sort of like go and find the ID the person who is ID the person who is the exemplar of whatever it is. Like if it's a town and there's like somebody who's in that town who sort of represents sort of the mainstream view of the town, and then I'd identify the outsider, the goth kid or whatever, who can sort of like have a more anthropological view of the town. And if you get both of those people, generally you're sort of circling around some sort of authentic picture of it. But you're always like, that's the biggest difficulty of being a journalist, is sort of like parachuting in some place, trying to get as much as you can about the place, but you never know. You never know as much as you wish you knew, and you never have time to figure it all out, you know, entirely. Generally, when I'm reporting on a topic, when I find that I have I'm getting the same answers from enough people, like when then I feel like, okay, well, I've done enough reporting now that I'm getting similar answers. Yeah.
Coming up, a sample from my episode with Arnold Schwarzenegger, the one and only, coming soon. But I'm going to give you a preview. But first, just a short word from our sponsors. The Tim Ferriss Show is brought to you by Onnit. I have used Onnit products for years. If you look in my kitchen, in my garage, you will find Alpha Brain, chewable melatonin for resetting my clock when I'm traveling, kettlebells, battle ropes, maces, steel clubs. It sounds like a torture chamber, and it kind of is. It's a torture chamber for self-improvement. And you can see all of my favorite gear at onnit.com/Tim. That's onnit.com/Tim. And you can also get a discount on any supplements, food products. I like Hemp Force. I like Alpha Brain. Check it all out on onnit.com/Tim. The Tim Ferriss Show is also brought to you by 99designs. 99 Designs is your one-stop shop for anything graphic design related. You need a logo, you need a website, you need a business card, or anything else. You get an original design from designers around the world who submit drafts for you to review. You are happy or you get your money back. And I have used 99 Designs for book cover ideas for the 4-Hour Body, which went to number one New York Times, for banner ads, and you can check out some of my actual competitions at 99designs.com/Tim. You can also get a free $99 upgrade if you want to give it a shot. That's 99designs.com/Tim. And now, back to the show.
In those days, there was no money in bodybuilding. And so when we didn't have enough money, we literally had to go to work. And so Franco and I, since Franco's talent was to be a bricklayer and a very skilled bricklayer and learned that in Italy and in Germany, we were able to go and start thinking about the idea of putting an ad in the LA Times, creating a company and calling it Europe in bricklayers and masonry experts, marble experts, building chimneys and fireplaces, the European style. And this was also a time where everything that was European was huge in America. So we benefited from that, you know, Swedish massages, and everything had to be kind of a foreign name, or Japanese this and this. So Europe and Japan and all these places, you know, were used, the names were used because for some reason or the other, people just thought that was better. And so we used that in the ad. And we put the ad in the paper. And literally a week later, we had the big earthquake in Los Angeles. And I mean, the chimneys fell off the apartment houses and all this stuff. And it cracked walls and all this. And so Frank and I, as a matter of fact, one of the friend of ours' wife, who was very smart, and she worked in a supermarket. She did answering the phones and calling people back and all this, just to make sure that our English doesn't get all screwed up with talking over the phone and all this. And so she gave us then the addresses, and then we got to do the estimates, and I was kind of like set up to be the math genius, and that figures out the square footage, and that Franco would play the bad guy, and I play the good guy. And so we would go to someone's house, and then someone would say, well, look at my patio. It's all cracked. Can you guys put a new patio in here? And I would say yes. And then I would run around with the tape measure. But there would be a tape measure with centimeters. And no one in those days could at all figure out anything with centimeters. And we would be measuring up. And I say, well, this is, you know, 4 meters and 82 centimeters. And they had no idea what we were talking about. And this is so much. And then I would be writing up formulas and the dollars and amounts and square centimeters and square meters and all this stuff. And then I would go to the guy and I said, it's $5,000. And the guy will be in a state of shock. And he says, it's $5,000? I said, this is outrageous. I said, I didn't think that this. I said, well, what did you expect the basis? I thought maybe it's like $2,000-$3,000. I said, but $5,000? I said, let me talk to my guy. I said, because he's really the masonry expert. I said, but I can beat him down for you a little bit. Yeah. Let me soften the meat. And then I would go over to Franco and we would start arguing in German. You know, this is eine Schweinerei. Du kannst nicht so viel verlangen. This is ein Blödsinn, wie wir arbeiten hier in America. And this would be going on and on. And he would be screaming back at me in Italian and some stuff. And then I would be, then all of a sudden he'd calm down and then I would go to the guy and say, phew. Okay, here it is. I said, I could get him as low as $3,800. I said, can you go with that? And he says, thank you very much. He says, you know, I really think that you're a great man, and blah, 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 and all this stuff. I said, give us half down right now. We go right away and get the cement and get the bricks and everything that we need for here, and we can start working, I said, on Monday. And the guy was ecstatic. He gave us the money. We immediately ran to the bank, cashed the check to make sure that the money's in the bank account. And then we went out and got the cement and the wheelbarrow and all the stuff that we needed and went to work. And so we worked like that for 2 years. I mean, very successfully. As a matter of fact, in the end, we had various different jobs where we employed like 16 different bodybuilders. All the laziest bastards that you can ever hire, but never because they all were interested in working outdoor and getting a tan at the same time for their bodybuilding competitions.
you enjoyed this episode, you are going to love what I have coming. All sorts of crazy experiments, incredible guests, and you can very easily not miss any of it. Just subscribe on iTunes, or you can check out all of my guests, as well as my blog that has 1 to 2 million readers per month at 4hourworkweek.com. All spelled out, 4hourworkweek.com. That's where I chronicle all of my insane self-experimentation. And I would love to hear from you. So please reach out to me on Twitter, twitter.com/tferriss, T-F-E-R-R-I-S-S, or on Facebook at facebook.com/timferriss with 2 R's and 2 S's, of course. And until next time, thank you so much for listening.